Chapter 10. Now Holmes was seeking out the worst slums in Washington, D.C. He walked west through the southern reaches of one of these slums, Foggy Bottom, a low-lying industrial area hosting the city's gasworks, some still-working glass plants amidst the stone and brick remains of their closed brethren, and a diminishing number of odoriferous breweries. The air here was thick enough and foul enough to justify the slum's name, some of the industrial miasma clearly visible as a sort of swirling green fog. As with all of Washington, D.C.'s worst slums, the inhabitants here built their shelters along the long, unpaved alleys. Many of the residents of Foggy Bottom were, or had been at one time, employed in these abandoned breweries and tumble-down manufacturing ruins. But the alleys were still lined with tin shacks and wooden hovels, many of them abandoned, but others still housing families or solitary, sullen men too poor to move elsewhere. Along with the miasma that hung over Foggy Bottom, there seemed to hover a second fog of vain hopes that industry and living wages would once again return to the disintegrating neighborhoods. Holmes found what he wanted near the southwest edge of Foggy Bottom. Five rotting, peeling, once middle-class homes standing amidst high weeds on an otherwise abandoned block. He chose his house carefully, walked around the back, and tested the still intact rear door. It was locked. These homes were almost certainly for sale, although their former owners and current sales agents were living in a fantasy world if they thought anyone would buy them now for purposes of residence. Using the small jimmy tools from his folded leather purse, Holmes let himself in and wandered through the chilly rooms where wallpaper, once eagerly chosen with hope in some long-failed domestic future, peeled away from clammy walls like skin from a corpse. Upstairs, he found what he'd sought, a locked closet. Holmes jimmied it open, undid the clasp of his bulging briefcase, and brought out a change of clothes. When he was completely changed, down to his underlinens, Holmes folded his good tweed Norwegian suit, shirt, shoes, and underclothes into the briefcase, set the briefcase on the high shelf of the otherwise empty closet, and used his tools to lock the warped door once again. There was no mirror left intact in the old house, but it had grown dark enough out under the advancing storm that Holmes could check his appearance in one of the long windows in an empty upstairs room. He was now a grubby American laborer, down to the thick boots and soiled Irish cap, complete with dirty waistcoat and baggy trousers held up with one suspender. He'd applied makeup to approximate months of grime to his face and hands and nails. Holmes allowed his hair to fall from beneath his foul cap at random, greasy angles, and now even his carefully trimmed Norwegian explorer's mustache had been augmented into an overgrown American's soup strainer. Even his fancy cane, the outer sheath slid away, was now a rough walking stick with a lump of brass rather than sculpted silver at its head. Unless someone hefted that stick, they wouldn't guess that it had a core of lead poured down its center, and a solid lead sphere centered under the wood in the rough knob at the top. He still carried the French gravity blade in the pocket of his working man's trousers, and kept the three photographs tucked securely in his shirt pocket. Holmes went out of the old house, locked it behind him, and walked south toward the southwest slums he sought, his stout stick banging against tilted sidewalk pavers and rough cobblestones as he went. No trace of either the Norwegian gentleman he was currently passing as or the English gentleman he'd so long passed as was left as he walked the rough, dangerous streets of southwest Washington, D.C. His disguise as an unemployed, rum-reeking, common American laborer did not feel strange on him. He had been pretending to be an English gentleman all of his adult life, and sometimes the pretense grew wearisome indeed. In the century and more to come from this moment in March of 1893, there will be multiple biographies written about Sherlock Holmes. Most will get his birth year, 1854, correct. Most will write about how he and his older brother Mycroft came from landed gentry in Yorkshire. They will tell of his youthful education in a Yorkshire manor and his years at Cambridge. Almost all of these facts, after the year of his birth, will be incorrect. Everything that future biographers, speculators, of Sherlock Holmes's past assume as true comes from a few words quoted by Dr. John Watson and published in The Strand in a tale titled The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter. The conversation between the doctor and the detective that particular lazy summer evening had been running in its desultory, spasmodic fashion from golf clubs to the causes of the change in the obliquity of the ecliptic. Note here that if Holmes had really not known that the Earth orbited the sun, he hardly could have been chatting about the obliquity of the ecliptic. When Watson changed the subject to hereditary aptitudes, the point under discussion, Watson reported in his chronicle, was how far any singular gift in an individual was due to his ancestry and how far to his own early training. In today's parlance, it was a discussion about nature versus nurture. Then Watson went on with his fateful four paragraphs. In your own case, said I, from all that you have told me, it seems obvious that your faculty of observation and your peculiar facility for deduction are due to your own training. To some extent, he, Holmes, answered thoughtfully. My ancestors were country squires who appeared to have led much the same life as is natural to their class. But, nonetheless, my turn that way is in my veins, and may have come with my grandmother, who was the sister of Vernet, the French artist. Art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms. But how do you know that it is hereditary? Because my brother Mycroft possesses it in a larger degree than I do. This was the only time, in hundreds of thousands of words chronicled by Watson, that Holmes will ever mention his ancestors. It was the first time he ever mentioned the existence of his brother Mycroft, and Watson was duly astonished. Yet nothing in this short revelation to Dr. Watson by Sherlock Holmes, other than Mycroft's existence, was true in any real sense. Not even the simple fact of his grandmother, who was the sister of Vernet, the French artist. There was, of course, a well-known French artist of the era, Émile Jean Horace Vernet, 1789 to 1863, whose specialty was painting scenes of battle and Orientalist Arab subjects. Vernet's most remembered painting in Holmes's and Watson's time, and in ours, was his large canvas titled Street Fighting on Rue Soufflot, Paris, June 25th, 1848. If Vernet is remembered for any utterance today, it is from the time when a patron asked him to remove the image of an especially obnoxious general from one of his battle paintings. I am a painter of history, sire, Vernet is reported to have said, and I will not violate the truth. But Holmes, in his recitation to Watson, certainly violated the truth. Émile Jean Horace Vernet had three brothers and one younger sister who died of typhus when she was 7 years old. She could hardly have been Sherlock Holmes's grandmother. William Sherlock Holmes had been born in the East Side slums of London and had spent the majority of his young years in those slums and on those rough streets. When the older Holmes summoned his barefoot ragamuffin group of street Arabs, his Baker Street irregulars, as he called them, he might as well have been summoning his much younger self. Future biographers will state with certainty, among other known facts, that Holmes's father was either an invalided-out cavalry lieutenant named Sigger Holmes or a member of the landed gentry named William Scott Holmes. Neither account has an ounce of truth to it. One famous biography of the great detective will have Sherlock's father and the Holmes family inheriting a Yorkshire estate called Mycroft, and will trace the family ownership of that grand estate back to the 1550s. This is nonsense and wholly manufactured. Holmes's actual family once had partial claim to some acres of land in Yorkshire, but it was a non-producing hard-scrabble farm during Queen Elizabeth's reign and had been under the mere hired management of Sherlock's uncle for only a few years when that man died in 1860, 2 years after Sherlock's mother, of whom the adult detective had no clear memory, died of consumption in an East Cheap boarding house. It's true that the Yorkshire farm once had held some delusions of grandeur. In the 16th century, the nobleman owner, who was not an ancestor of Sherlock Holmes, had begun work on a grand country house there that was to be known as Ashcroft Manor. But the nobleman had made the mistake of remaining a practicing Catholic when England had been converted, forcibly when necessary, to the Church of England. And by 1610, Ashcroft Manor had been burned to ashes, and equally vanished were the fortune and hopes of the noble squire who had so briefly owned the land. History reports that the lord cut his own throat. He had no male descendants who lived beyond the age of 11. In centuries to come, some Yorkshire locals still referred to the ever-dwindling estate, dwindling due to inevitable entailment of commons and larger sections being sold off to pay debts by the distant relatives who'd assumed ownership of the farm, as Ashcroft Farm. But by 1800, the appellation had become Ash Heap Acres, after the chimneys and windowless brick buildings of a profitless lead mine that had been built on the remaining 60 acres in a last-ditch effort by an American cousin to earn some money from the place. Until the lead works closed down in 1838, Ash Heap Acres often filled the entire Yorkshire Valley with a thick, dark cloud of unhealthy, lead-laced smoke. After the death of Sherlock's uncle Sherrinford in 1860, he had been administering Ash Heap Acres for an absentee Birmingham landlord. Sherlock's father had bought, at far too high a price, that overmined and overgrown Yorkshire farm, and then brought the 13-year-old Mycroft and 6-year-old Sherlock out to the remaining 38 acres of ruined woodland, unyielding fields, grazed out pastures, and polluted swamp. Mycroft never left his small room while there, but the farm, what was left of it, was an exploratory and play-filled heaven to the young Sherlock. He even had a sway-backed pony to ride during those 3 golden years in the Yorkshire Dales. But by early 1863, Sherlock's father, who was both a drunkard and spendthrift, and who, in young Sherlock's memory, had spent most of his time at Ash Heap Acres riding the plow horse to nearby Swinton to waste his nights and many days in Swaledale's more sordid public houses, had lost ownership of the farm after spending the last of his brother Sherrinford's money. Then in 1863, the father and his 2 extraordinary but unappreciated sons returned to London and a succession of ever more seedy rental homes and boarding houses. For Sherlock, it meant a return to their family life of always fleeing their creditors and his return to the streets. But Mycroft, turning 16 that year, did not return to London with them. He went to Oxford instead. Even while in exile at Ash Heap Acres in the Yorkshire Dales, their father had used Mycroft's mathematical gifts to have his son pour through racing touts' data sheets and pick future thoroughbred winners sold at Tattersall in London and Hyde Park. And then Holmes Sr., after cabling cronies in the city, would place bets on those very horses at Alexandra Park's The Frying Pan Racecourse in the city. What Sherlock had noticed in those years, but their father hadn't, was that Mycroft, seemingly as lazy and listless as he was overweight and brilliant, had been taking money from his father's bets to place his own racing wagers, adding his secret picks through the agency of his father's crony, who lived in London, and returning his smaller but ever accruing winnings to a separate account. By 1863, 16-year-old Mycroft Holmes had set aside quite a bit of money, and he knew precisely how he was going to spend it. Mycroft qualified to enter Oxford at the age of 16, paid his tuition and board with what he called his Tattersall frying pan money, and late one night, after waking his younger brother and uncharacteristically shaking hands with young Sherlock, Mycroft hated touching or being touched by other people, took himself off to Oxford. He brought with him only his cardboard suitcase containing a few clothes and a cheese sandwich Sherlock had made for him. Over the next few years, disowned by his furious father, Mycroft sent Sherlock elaborately encrypted letters in which the older brother described how he reveled in everything that venerable institution had to offer, including the friendship of a certain mathematics professor at Christ Church named Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, soon to be known to the world as Lewis Carroll. Mycroft and Dodgson soon became fast friends, sharing their excitement about mathematics, especially prime numbers, difficult codes, and odd patterns of numbers within such everyday things as railway schedules. William Sherlock Holmes never met Dodgson. The younger son spent the later years of the 1860s and early 1870s fighting for his survival in the rough streets of London. In the late 1870s, Mycroft Holmes plucked his younger brother out of the streets and paid to send him to Oxford. Sherlock refused to attend a school where his older brother had been such a well-known and admired figure. Mycroft then used the money to send his brother to Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, where he hoped Sherlock would focus on natural sciences. Sherlock enjoyed some of his chemical laboratory time at Cambridge, but hated his instructors and fellow students, and soon dropped out, twice. To get a glimpse of the actual biography of the early years of Sherlock Holmes, a biography that will never be written, one might use as a template a biography of the younger years of James Joyce, with his drunken, often abusive father, first renting fine homes in neighborhoods such as Kensington and then fleeing landlords demanding rent, dragging his sons to ever dirtier and more cramped rental houses, and then to seedy rooms in boarding houses smelling of boiled cabbage. Sherlock had almost no formal education until his brief stint at Cambridge, had never attended a school, public or private, and had only intermittent tutors at home when his father had made a score on the ponies or some other shady venture. While Holmes's father, during the brief periods he had a few coins and he and his son were not actively fleeing landlords in the night, had the habit of hiring a succession of fairly useless, and soon to throw up their hands in surrender, tutors for young Sherlock, the senior Holmes did spend real money on excellent instructors in five areas of young Sherlock Holmes's instruction: single-stick combat, which Sherlock studied from the age of 7 onwards, boxing, including time spent sparring with several retired but still famous English champion prize fighters, 4 years of having a Thai expert teach him the intricacies of Muay Boran martial arts, fencing, the most expensive instruction, the young Holmes sometimes taught by top French fencing experts even when the family could barely afford food, and shooting. It was as if Sherlock's father envisioned his strange, wild, but often withdrawn and brooding younger son becoming a soldier someday. Sherlock Holmes, of course, even at the age of 8 or 14, had no more interest in ever being a soldier than he had in being the first aeronaut to travel via balloon to the moon. It had begun to rain. Holmes carried no umbrella, of course, since his down-at-the-heels working-class American disguise would not have included such a thing, so he simply pulled his soiled and ancient Irish cloth cap lower over his brow and kept slogging along as the paved streets finally gave out for good. Streets, as such, had all but disappeared in this part of the southwest slums and had been replaced by countless hovel-lined alleys consisting of mud and deep ruts and the occasional board thrown down to more easily traverse some important short distance, as from a tumble-down tin shack to a three-sided wooden privy. His contacts in New York had told him that for what he sought, he should seek out a former blacksmith shop on what was called Casey's Alley. But of course there were no street signs here in the slums, no corner policemen from whom to ask directions. Not that he would have given them to the unemployed bounder likes of Holmes. And when Holmes asked directions of some raggedy children playing at torturing a rat, they responded by throwing horse apples at his head. Before he found the abandoned blacksmith shop and the men he sought, Holmes came across the sort of abandoned commercial building he'd hoped to find amidst these shacks and empty factories. He stepped up onto the structure's disintegrating wooden sidewalk, kicked open the warped front door, and looked inside. It had been a cheap railroad men's hotel at one point in the past. The tracks, rusted over now, ran next to it in the high weeds, but now it was home to only pigeons and four-legged vermin. Not even the poorest families from the nearby slums sought shelter here. The reason was fascinating to Holmes. In the large sitting room just off what had once served as a small reception lobby, the ceiling had collapsed in a strange way that had created a rough circle almost 10 feet across. It was a four-story building, and what made that collapsed ceiling interesting to Holmes was that, peering carefully up through the aperture, he could see similar round cavities on what Americans counted as the second, third, and fourth stories. Staring upward, Holmes's face grew wetter from a constant drizzle dropping through a gap in the old hotel's rooftop some 50 feet above. What could have weighed so much that it tore such a vertical path through a ceiling and 3 floors and a rooftop? Granting that the rain and rot had been far advanced when the event occurred, not even the heaviest of beds or metal safes or player pianos could carve out such destruction through a thick roof and 3 such reinforced layers of flooring. There was no clue on the ground floor where Holmes stood, save for a purplish-red discoloration that had ruined the splintered floorboards in a 15-foot-wide asterisk. It was as if 20 or so absurdly obese men had clustered tightly together on the 4th floor and fallen through 3 floors before splattering to their death here in the wide sitting room just off the lobby. The man who had billed himself as the world's first consulting detective, despite scores of private detectives also working in London at the time, did not put much faith in this primary hypothesis of the case of the falling fat men. But the hotel would serve. The banister and railings were fallen away on much of the central staircase, but the stairs themselves might hold. 2 muddy blocks further on, he found 3 walls and a canvas sheet, the remains of what had once been a blacksmith shop. Besides the old sign hanging slack from 1 hook, there was a rusted anvil lying in the alley mud. Clues enough for the world's first and foremost consulting detective. Holmes stepped up onto a wooden platform hardly less muddy than the alley below and moved the canvas aside with the knob of his lead-cored walking stick. Smoking and sorting through what appeared to be piles of trash tossed onto a low table were 3 of the roughest-looking scoundrels Sherlock Holmes had ever encountered in the daylight. 2 of them, they looked like idiot brothers, had arms so long and expressions behind their red stubble so primitive that they might have stepped out of a Stone Age troglodyte diorama in the British Natural History Museum. The 3rd man smelled so strongly of body odor that the stench seemed to shove Holmes physically back against the filthy canvas wall. The tall man had a sheath on the belt around his sagging, patched trousers, and in that sheath was a Bowie knife the length of some Afghani and Zulu short swords Holmes had seen.
"What the fuck do you want?"
said the taller man with the knife. He put a grimy hand on the heavy hilt.
"Someone told me that you could come up with the amount of morphine I need," said Holmes in his best Philadelphia American accent.
Holmes had first seen the United States when he toured in the 1870s with Percy Alexander's acting troupe. 19 cities in 7 months, and he had taken care at the time to acquire as many regional dialects as he might need in the future.
"And heroin,"
added Holmes.
"I want heroin. If you don't have the morphine, I'll take the heroin."
The tall man looked at Holmes's worn work boots and patched clothing, smirked, and said,
"Who's to tell us you ain't a blue coat without the fucking coat?" "I'm not a copper," said Holmes. "Take your shirt off," said the man with the knife. "Roll up your sleeve."
Shaking slightly, Holmes removed his jacket, rough waistcoat, and workman's wool shirt, and rolled up his torn and dirty undershirt. All 3 of the men leaned forward to look at the constellation of scabs and scars on his inner arm.
"He slams regular on something,"
said the 2nd troglodyte, his hairy face hovering close to Holmes's bare arm.
"Shut up, Finn,"
said the tall man.
Then who says you got the fucking money?
Said the other troglodyte.
Shut up, Finn,
snapped the man with the Bowie knife. Evidently, since they were obviously brothers, calling both of the troglodytes by the same name saved time. Before the closer Finn backed away, Holmes caught a glimpse of a crudely tattooed in blue ink ST on his right wrist. This told Holmes that he was in the right place, at least according to his connections in Hell's Kitchen in New York. He wanted to make contact with someone in the Washington gang known as the Southwest Toughs. It looked as though he had. That tall man pointed at Holmes.
This ain't Chinatown. Not even a hospital nearby to get supplies from. Mr. Bayer's schmeck comes pure, but it costs more hereabouts. You got what it takes to get it?
I have money,
whined Holmes in the desperate tones of an addict. He pulled out a thick wad of American bills.
I guess you do, pal,
said the tall man with his fingers tapping idly on the hilt of the knife.
Finn, both of you, go get Mr. Culpepper and Mr. J, now!
Holmes saw a not unfamiliar light come into their eyes then, although the man with the knife at least tried to conceal his gleam. They were going to kill him for the cash. Chapter 11. With the Finns gone, there were only the three of them in the canvas-walled blacksmith shop. Holmes, the tall man with the big knife, and the tall man's body odor. Holmes stayed silent. The man with the knife stared at him without speaking, and the stench spoke for itself. Less than 10 minutes later, the Finns returned with two well-dressed men. One was tall, thin, and silent, with the slightest trace of thin mustache above perfectly formed lips. He had very dark hair and the kind of pale to translucent skin that meant even by this time in the early afternoon, he could have used a second shave of the day, although everything else about the man was impeccable. There was not the slightest hint of mud on his polished shoes or white spats. This tall, thin, silent man was dressed well enough that he could have joined Wall Street executives or, closer to home, Washington's annual Easter parade on K Street without looking out of place. The other, shorter and heavier fellow, while expensively dressed, showed too many vulgar aspects not to stand out amongst real gentlemen. He sported a gold tooth that matched the gold-colored threads in his elaborate waistcoat. Visible above the waistcoat, most of it tucked into his impossibly clean trousers given the mud of Casey's Alley, was the butt of a double-action pistol. A new brown felt Homburg was perched above his greased back black hair. He was smiling.
Good God, Murtrick,
gasped the shorter, heavier newcomer with the pistol.
It's powerful rank in here. It's almost April. Haven't you taken your annual bath yet?
He waved the Finns out of the little shop, and Holmes could hear the brothers' boots squelching in the mud outside. The tall, thin man leaned back against a counter, only after dusting it with his handkerchief, and watched the proceedings in continued silence. The vulgarly dressed man extended a rough hand.
Howard Culpepper,
he said in a rich baritone. Holmes shook hands with him. If this was Culpepper, then the younger, silent man must be Mr. J, obviously the most important of the five thieves. The man Culpepper had called Murtrick never quit tapping at the hilt of his huge knife. Holmes felt in luck that his first real contact in Washington was this Culpepper fellow. Based on his flashy dress and confident attitude, he might possibly be high enough up in the city's criminal organization to answer Holmes's questions, if given the proper incentive. He doubted very much if Mr. J would be so foolish as to give names, or any useful information for that matter.
And your name, sir?
Asked Culpepper.
Henry Baskers, said Holmes.
Well, Mr. Baskers, I apologize if your host has not, for the olfactory unpleasantness currently haunting our temporary place of business,
said Culpepper.
You've seen the local neighborhood, sir? Water has to be carried down here by hand all the way from 4½ Street. There's not so much as a single public pump in all of this southwest quarter.
He squinted at Murtrick.
But that is little excuse, since civilization demands a price.
Murtrick never took his eyes off Holmes, who had nothing to say to all of this. He allowed himself to show several subtle signs of nervousness without overplaying his role. Mr. Baskers would have purchased illicit drugs in unsavory places before this. From time to time, Holmes allowed his nervous gaze to flick to Mr. J, as if he were one gentleman appealing for help from another. But the tall man leaned against the counter with a withdrawn silence bordering on complete indifference. It was as if he weren't there. But Culpepper rubbed his palms together.
To business, then, sir. My confederates tell me that you wish to purchase a modest amount of morphine and, how shall I put it, a more significant amount of Mr. Bayer's new heroic pharmaceutical.
Yes, said Holmes. He repeated the amount of each he was ready to purchase.
You're aware, Mr. Baskers, said Culpepper, that Bayer has not yet fully released this miraculous heroin for general sale either in Europe or the United States. Soon it will be on every grocery store's shelf, but right now it is undergoing, what do they call it, trials in select hospitals, including Dr. Reed's clinic.
Holmes nodded impatiently. He allowed his gaze to remain riveted on the three bottles of heroin salts Culpepper was holding between the fingers of his right hand, like a magician preparing to do a trick. Each label read, Frieder Bayer and Company, Elberfeld, 40 Stone Street, New York. In truth, Holmes was also noting the make and model of the pistol set in Culpepper's tight waistband. It was familiar to the detective, since not only was it British-made, but had been standard issue for the British military until it had been replaced by the Enfield pistol in 1880. It was the .442 caliber Beaumont Adams revolver that had become so famous in England's war with the Zulus. This model, almost certainly modified, as so many had been that had seen action in America's Civil War, to take center fire cartridges. This pistol had sported the first modern double action system. Holmes knew that many American officers and cavalry in their Civil War had preferred it to the American military Colt due to the Beaumont Adams's superior trigger cocking speed and more rapid rate of fire in close action. He wondered idly if Culpepper had been an officer in that war, now almost 30 years in the past, and if he kept this pistol for reasons of sentimentality. Based on the gray in the man's sideburns and the obvious use of hair-darkening materials elsewhere under that Homburg, perhaps the same patent goop Holmes was using in his Sigerson disguise, Culpepper could easily be in his late 50s or early 60s. Holmes assumed that Mr. J was also armed, but almost certainly with a much smaller and more sensible pistol to carry in a city.
The morphine will cost you only $20, said Culpepper, holding the two smaller vials in his left hand.
That was twice what Holmes would pay for it near one of the hospitals, or in the Negro sections of town just a dozen alleys from here. As if reading Holmes's thoughts, Culpepper chuckled and said,
Yes, yes, you could get it for less in Niggertown, Mr. Baskers, but God knows what our darky friends might have mixed into it. And as for the heroin, no, you have come to the one and only supplier in your nation's capital, sir. You will find it nowhere else.
Holmes knew that this wasn't true either, but he said,
How much for the three bottles of salts?
$150, sir, said Culpepper.
Even Murtrick glanced over at the well-dressed man in surprise. This was more than four times the street price Holmes would have paid for an equal amount of the drug in New York. He wrestled visibly with the shock of the price, allowing only the slightest hint of the serious addict's always losing war between absolute need and mere money to show on his face.
Oh, what the heck, laughed Culpepper.
We'll throw both morphines in as part of the price.
A better deal you'll get nowhere east of the Mississippi, Mr. Baskers.
Holmes swallowed hard and nodded.
All right.
He watched both men's eyes glint as he counted $150 from his absurd wad of American bills. He was carrying more than $800 with him, every bit of what he'd brought from France and converted to dollars in New York. When the transaction was completed and the morphine and heroin bottles nestled most carefully in Holmes's various jacket pockets, Culpepper asked in a casual tone,
Will we be having the pleasure of your future business, Mr. Baskers? I can give you the address of one of my, less fragrant and more convenient places of business.
This was it. If Holmes told them that he was going to be a regular customer, they might let him live. At these extortionate prices for heroin alone, they could have his remaining $650 in a few months without resorting to violence. Over a year or two, he would be worth a true fortune to them.
No,
said Holmes.
I'm leaving tomorrow for San Francisco. I'm from Philadelphia and didn't know if the heroin was in use out there yet, and so I thought...
We understand,
grinned Culpepper. He gave Murtrick the briefest of glances.
Have a safe trip, Mr. Baskers.
Mr. J did not even turn his head to watch as Holmes left the former blacksmith shop. Chapter 12. They'd sent one of the Finns to follow him up Casey's Alley. Following a man surreptitiously up such a narrow venue, crowded as its sides were with a contiguous wall of shacks and tumble-down ruins, would have been difficult enough when the dirt street was dry. With the mud, it was impossible. Holmes squelched northward, never looking back, assured that this Finn was merely keeping him in sight while the other three men, or possibly more by now, were moving up an adjacent north-south alley. When Holmes stopped, this Finn would get the word to the others in less than a minute. Culpepper and Murtrick would be betting that this addict's need was so great that he could not wait to get back to his hotel, but would seek out a private place along the way in which to inject his newly acquired heroin. They would also be banking that Holmes, Mr. Baskers, would do this before he left the slums of the Southwest Quarter. Holmes would not disappoint them. He left the door of the abandoned hotel ajar behind him. The giant stain in the floor of the large room off the lobby remained just as disturbing as at first encounter, and the three stories of cratered floorboards beginning with that room's ceiling just as shocking. The cold spring rain had settled into a heavy drizzle, and it continued to fall through the shattered rooftop more than three stories above.
Perhaps a meteor or comet struck the hotel,
was the ironic thought that came from the most reasoned and deductive mind in England. Holmes was in great physical pain. The morphine he'd injected that morning had been the last of his store, had been far too little for the pain that had accrued over the past week, and pain continued to distract him despite his years of disciplining himself to ignore it. A gunshot wound, something less than mortal, would have distracted him less than this ferocious full body ache that came from too long of an interval between applications of his ameliorative. He climbed the stairs slowly, testing each one carefully before committing his weight. The wood was soaked and rotten, but had once been a sound and noble wood, and only a few steps had to be avoided completely. The railing was continuous for the length of its long, curving climb, but so many balusters had fallen away that nowhere was the banister solid enough to hold a person's weight, should he or she be pressed against it. Between what the Americans called the second and third stories, there was almost no banister at all. He turned into the dripping, wallpaper-curling corridor on the fourth floor and threw his shoulder against the warped door of his chosen room. This was it. There was a rotting floor intact for only 18 inches or more before the huge cavity began. Holmes could see lathing and shards of ancient carpet that had been left in the interstices between joints when the impossible weight had crashed down for 40 feet. There was space enough only on the right side of the crater to edge around the hole in this unfurnished room, and the constant drizzle from above, lit by the dim sunlight coming through gray clouds, gave an eerie and unreal illumination to the bare walls and remnant of floor and ceiling. Holmes had hoped that there'd be room enough against the wall opposite the doorway for him, and there was. Just 4 feet or so of downward sloping floor there before the hole began. If Culpepper wanted to kill him, all he had to do was open the door, aim, and fire. Their target would be fewer than 20 feet away. But the odds of Mr. Baskers falling forward after being shot by a .442 caliber ball were almost 100%, and it was Holmes's mortal wager that Culpepper and Murtrick, or whatever their real names were, wanted the bottles of morphine and heroin intact after their other thievery was finished. Holmes squeezed against the wall opposite the mild waterfall and empty space separating him across the room from the door he'd closed behind him, and then slid down that wall, hoping the sloping floor would hold his weight. It did, although it groaned in protest. He got out one of the bottles and his leather syringe kit. In France and during the crossing, Holmes had pondered the wisdom of arming himself with a pistol. He'd had one in India, but France had been so peaceful. Even the time he'd spent with the experimental chemists in Montpellier, where he'd decided to wean himself off morphine by shifting to this newer, safer drug, that he'd had no need of a firearm there. His last chance to pick one up had been his one night in New York, but he'd been so busy there getting information about possible contacts in Washington that he hadn't had time to go pistol shopping. In truth, the thought had never entered his mind while he was there. Sitting with his knees apart and one shoe bracing the bottle on the floorboards should it roll toward the terrible crater, Holmes set out his various apparatuses and smiled. In Watson's many written adventures and cases, most of which he kept in his older medical satchel on the shelf in his room and which the public had not yet heard of or read, Watson almost always portrayed himself as the one who brought a pistol to the adventure when a pistol was needed. In truth, despite the hundreds of hours of shooting instruction by his father and many more hours of lonely practice since, Holmes did indeed dislike firearms of any sort. But he smiled again at the memory of Watson, always describing his own pistol only as my old, or trusty, service revolver. But his medical friend had learned enough about writing from Conan Doyle to know that readers were bored by details. Holmes lived, and would probably die someday, for details. He'd noticed the first time Watson had ever armed himself for one of their mutual adventures that the service revolver was an Adams six-shot caliber .450 breechloader with a 6-inch barrel, standard issue for the British Army during the Second Afghan War in which Watson had received his suspiciously mobile Jezail bullet. Dr. Watson's weapon was not so different in size and capability from the Beaumont Adams pistol that Culpepper had been showing off from his belted waistband. Holmes had noticed that the dandy had worn both braces, suspenders, as Mr. Baskers would call them here in America, and a thick belt. Mr. Culpepper was a cautious man. Just how cautious, thought Holmes, they would all soon see. Perhaps all five of them are carrying pistols by now, was Holmes's last thought before he heard the front door of the hotel being forced open 3 stories below. But no, Holmes felt certain, to his deep disappointment, that Mr. J had not joined this expedition. He'd certainly returned to report the interaction to his own superior, which meant that he would have to leave at least one of the 4 men tracking him alive, but not necessarily Culpepper. Holmes's materials were set before him on the leather cloth. He'd preloaded his syringe with salt water, and now he brought out a bottle cap taken from a bottle of Heyer's root beer he'd purchased earlier in the morning, after renting his magic lantern projector. Holmes had tossed away the bottle and its contents. Hideous stuff, root beer. He wondered how Americans could buy and guzzle 3 million bottles of it a year. Now he filled the bottle cap with the heroin salts and then squeezed out enough water to liquefy the salts. From another pouch in his unrolled leather bag, Holmes extracted the bit of chemical tubing he'd used that morning to tie off his arm. He did so again, tapping at the veins on the inside of his elbow, and then, from his waistcoat pocket, brought forth perhaps the most unique device he owned, a prototype cigarette lighter presented to Holmes in 1891, just months before his self-disappearance, by a satisfied client, a scientist by the name of Karl Auer von Welsbach. The patenting of a flint-like substance called ferrocerium allowed the von Welsbach lighter to be small, simple, and safe in comparison to the bulky, complex, and extremely dangerous Dobereiner flame makers of decades past. He held the blue flame from von Welsbach's gift under the bottle cap. The von Welsbach lighter had saved Holmes's life numerous times in the Himalayas. Now he asked it only to work quickly, so he could heat the heroin crystal salt water mixture before the audible footsteps on the stairway reached his floor. Holmes took a small pellet of cotton he'd been carrying in his shirt pocket next to the three photographs and dropped the cotton wad onto the Heinz bottle cap he was using for a cooker. The cotton acted as a filter, blocking the inevitable undissolved clumps of heroin salts that would clog the syringe and stop his heart. The footsteps were climbing above the second-story landing. Holmes lifted the filled syringe, tapped it, squirted a tiny bit to be sure there were no air bubbles, and leaned over to inject the contents into his vein. It sounded like only four men, not five, climbing to the fourth floor. They were trying to climb quietly, but not too quietly. They obviously weren't overly concerned as to whether meek Mr. Baskers heard them or not. What could he do if he did? Holmes wanted time for the heroin to take effect. He tugged the tubing off, emptied and disassembled the syringe, and put the bottles, bottle cap, and precious von Welsbach cigarette lighter back in their proper places. The heroin hit his system almost at once. First came the glowing warmth filling his heart, chest, torso, limbs, and then brain. Then came the fading of all pain, especially the pain of his question of existence or non-existence. And then came the sense of rising on the crest of a curling wave. The footsteps stopped outside the door of his room. Holmes vaguely heard whispering. He ignored it. Rising rapidly on that silent wave, he could see and sense his own life better now. He could make out the lacunae, the ellipses, the terrible gaps between his so-called cases, his so-called adventures, his so-called life as a famous consulting detective. Those days or weeks or sometimes months between the cases that Watson had been feverishly chronicling were not a memory of life. They were a glimpse of rough sketches with faces not drawn in, backgrounds not sketched, days not filled. Holmes remembered screeching his bow on his expensive violin. He remembered injecting cocaine. He remembered sleeping long afternoons and fooling around in his locked room with his chemistry set like a child, bubbling things, burning things. He remembered the ghost of Mrs. Hudson, carrying trays into the common room, carrying trays out. There were a few times when Mrs. Hudson, still looking and sounding like Mrs. Hudson in Holmes's memory, had been inexplicably referred to as Mrs. Turner in Watson's chronicles. All that was a blur now. None of it had any sense of solidity or the simple taste of the real. The warped door was shoved open. The fins came in, almost tiptoeing, like cartoon characters from Comic Cuts, Ally Sloper's Half Holiday, or Illustrated Chips, all guilty favorites of Dr. Watson. Holmes ignored them. He had no time left, but he also had no choices left. He had to see what the drug would allow him to see before he could pay attention to his would-be murderers. Holmes's consciousness had expanded until he came up against the horizontal iron bars of his cage. The bars were not solid. Sections of different lengths floated in the gray air. No, not air, some gelatinous ether in front of him. But no two horizontal blocks were far enough apart that he could press his head or shoulders between them. Holmes realized that the floating horizontal elements of his cage were distinct words, giant words, separate words like slugs of type set into a gelatinous void of a medium. But the huge words and sentences were written backward from his point of view. Holmes grabbed at two of the longer, floating words. The metal was so cold it burned his hands, and he stared through the imprisoning word bars with the expression of a madman or a castaway seeing his first ship in years receding from view. Holmes looks at you. He sees the blurred outlines of the room or space behind you. He strains to make out your face.
"He slammed," said one of the Finns.
"He's all shot up. He ain't even half here," said the other Finn.
"Shut up,"
snapped Murtrick. All four men were inside the open door now, the Finns and Murtrick having worked their way carefully around to their right, Holmes's left. But Culpepper stayed in the doorway.
"Braces and belt,"
Holmes remembered through the glow and wondrous, fearless terror of the heroine. If Culpepper remained a truly cautious man for the next 2 minutes, Mr. Sherlock Holmes of London would soon be a corpse. Holmes had tucked away his leather foldaway and was on his knees as if praying to the drizzle falling vertically in front of him. Somewhere above the hole in the ceiling, the sun had grown brighter. The waterfall was now made of skeins of liquid gold. Holmes's walking stick was propped against the wall behind him and to the right. It would be most awkward for him to try to reach it and would take too long to try. The three men creeping up on him noted this. Holmes's eyes were not focused on anything, but he vaguely noticed that Murtrick had removed the Bowie knife from its sheath. Culpepper had removed the revolver from his waistband. The Finns now raised their Paleolithic clubs. Then Culpepper stepped into the room and wedged shut the door behind him. Most probably it was just old habit, seeking some privacy for a murder. Holmes had instinctively hoped for such a habit to be there, but he had not been certain. He had not been certain. Now he seemed to take no notice. Now all four men were moving carefully around the perimeter of the terrible hole in the floor, keeping as close to the west wall of the empty room as possible. The Finns kept glancing down into the cavity with something like terror in their little troglodyte eyes. Holmes decided that it would have to be one of the Finns who should survive and carry back the details of this encounter to Mr. J and his superiors.
"Don't cluster too close when you get him," whispered Culpepper,
following them but staying several paces back, then stopping completely at the west side of the hole while watching the other three advance.
"The floor might not hold you there if you cluster up. We need the bottles intact."
No one said anything, but the three men opened more distance between themselves. The Finns shouldered their short clubs with nails driven through the working ends. Murtrick had his knife and was moving in an experienced knife fighter's crouch. Culpepper held his pistol loosely down at his side. Every inch the vision of the accomplished duelist anticipating another easy victory. The Beaumont Adams revolver's hammer was cocked. Holmes had not turned his head to watch their final approach. His eyes were vacant, the drug obviously in full control. There was a single drop of blood on the inside of his still bare left arm. The Finns attacked, with Murtrick close behind. Holmes, so cool behind his buffer that he watched with the most disinterested attention imaginable, whirled away from the attacking men as if attempting a retreat into the dead-end corner where the crater came all the way to the east wall. But the whirl was no half-turn away. He twirled almost completely around and came up out of his crouch with his walking stick in his hand. The Finns shouted a single primal scream and raised their clubs. Decades of single-stick practice guided Holmes's two-second blur of six blows, two lateral swings to break their right arms, two vertical swings to club their underjaws and drop them to their knees, two fluidly vicious downward swings, one to crush the larger Finn's skull, a lesser blow to knock the slightly shorter Finn down, but to leave him semi-conscious. Murtrick had made the mistake of staring at the blur of violence and leaping blood, but now he leaped closer, crouched lower, swung the deadly blade to the right, to the left. He jumped over the dead fins, one motionless on its face, a river of blood flowing from his ears, the other twitching on his back, moaning as he cradled his aching head and bleeding scalp with both hands. Holmes took a step backward, not because he feared Murtrick's blade or needed the room, but because he was sending a subliminal message to Culpepper to join the fray.
Come closer.
The dandy did take two steps closer, but still stayed well out of club range. His pistol was raised, but the man was obviously waiting for Murtrick to do his job.
The heroin bottles,
he screamed at his stinking friend.
Don't break them!
The Bowie knife was its own blur. Holmes was fast enough with his stick to have batted it across the room in the quarter of a second when Murtrick tossed it from hand to hand. The man was obviously as ambidextrous at ripping his enemies open from sternum to crotch as he was filthy, but Holmes had use for the knife stuck in the floor here, not lost down the golden waterfall hole or sticking from an unreachable wall or door across the room. He risked more by waiting for Murtrick to sweep the blade a final time and then lunge forward in a ballet-beautiful single motion. Only in Spain and once in Calcutta had Holmes seen knife fighters perform that brilliantly. It was precisely the kind of super-fast knife move, Holmes knew, that almost always left the expert knife wielder's opponent's bowels hanging out and then dropping to the floor with that ultimately final, squishy sound that the horrified and dying victim lived long enough to see and hear. The length of a Bowie knife only made that full hari-kari more likely, but the weight of Mr. Bowie's famous blade and hilt did slow the killing move by that necessary fraction of a second on which Holmes counted. Holmes arched his body while balancing on his heels. The tip of the Bowie knife took a button off his waistcoat, and then he slammed his weighted stick down on Murtrick's right hand. The knife dropped and embedded its point in the floor exactly where Holmes had wished it. And then, without pausing in its complex arc, the stick swung up and caught Murtrick in the side of the head. Dazed, Murtrick wobbled toward the drop, started to go over. Holmes grabbed the man, then pulled him toward his own chest with what felt like an infinitely powerful, heroin-assisted left hand, keeping his stick in his right hand between them. Holmes brought his face so close to Murtrick's, it seemed as if he was going to kiss the semi-conscious thug. Then Holmes lowered his face to the man's chest, making himself smaller as he pushed both of them forward around the perimeter of the crater. The four cracks from the .442 Beaumont Adams revolver seemed to reach Holmes hours after the impact had shattered the back of Murtrick's skull, lodged in the man's spine, blown his left shoulder into bone fragments, and passed through his body, that final ball passing between Holmes's right arm and his torso. It was a five-shot pistol, but Holmes had pushed the upright corpse up and into Culpepper by this point, and the fifth shot blew wet plaster out of the rotted ceiling. Holmes dropped Murtrick's corpse, unhurriedly clubbed the empty gun out of Culpepper's hand, and dragged him back to where he had injected the heroin, both men doing rather dainty dances over the three fallen bodies. The rotted and tilting floor sagged under their weight, but Holmes needed Culpepper near the knife embedded hilt up in those groaning floorboards. He swung Culpepper around and shoved him toward the edge of the hole, stopping his fall only with his left hand grasping the older man's jacket collar. Culpepper teetered and whimpered. Holmes suddenly smelled urine. Holmes tossed away his club and reached into his shirt pocket to retrieve the three photographs there. Still holding Culpepper at a steep angle over the drop, he thrust the first photograph, the one of the older, heavier, dark-eyed, mustached man, in front of the murderer's face.
"Do you know this man?" barked Holmes. "Have you ever seen him?"
"No."
Culpepper's baritone was now a soprano's quaver.
"Make sure," said Holmes. "I don't know which of the Southwest Tufts bosses you report to. Dillon, Meyer, Shelton. But it would have been at their headquarters, maybe in their office, or perhaps this man and your boss dining together." I've never seen him,
screeched the dangling man. Every time Culpepper tried to bring his arms back to grab at Holmes, the detective let him tilt a little more over the drop. Culpepper quit trying to grab and let his pudgy hands and arms flap like a pigeon's broken wings. Holmes pocketed that photo and brought forth the photograph of the much younger man, in profile. Thin lips, long, straight nose, hair combed back, eyes as light as a reptile's. The image terrified Holmes even in the perfectly disinterested state the heroine had granted him. Culpepper's hesitation told Holmes what he needed to know.
Tell me, now!
He said, and let the big man tilt a few more inches forward. Holmes's left arm and hand were growing tired. He knew he'd almost dropped Culpepper 3 stories by accident right then. That would never do, but he couldn't change hands. Not yet.
Tell me now, he bellowed.
I think I saw this fellow, maybe once. Dear Jesus, don't drop me.
Holmes pulled him a few inches closer.
A couple of years ago,
babbled Culpepper.
Maybe 3. At Sheldon's office on Pennsylvania Avenue.
What was his name?
I just saw him from a distance, quavered Culpepper. I swear to God, if I knew anything more about him, I'd tell you. I swear to God.
Please don't push me. Please don't drop me. I'll change my life. I swear to Jesus Christ. And this man?
Demanded Holmes, showing the 3rd photograph, the oldest of the 3 in the photographs. One of a shockingly pale and cadaverous-looking, hollow-cheeked and balding man. But the sharpness of features does not create sympathy in the viewer. This face is one of a predator, not of a victim or prey. One's first impression is of an almost disturbingly large shelf and dome of white forehead looming above deep-set eyes, magnified by old-fashioned pince-nez spectacles. The sense of the older man being an intellectual, created by the oversized forehead and glimpse of old-fashioned collar, ribbon tie, frock coat, and pince-nez, is immediately counteracted by the sharp and strong jut of the older man's chin, from which various and strong and somehow angry-looking cords of wrinkle and muscle rise to the sharp cheekbones and to both sides of the vulpine blade of a nose. It is a predatory face, made even more raptor-like by the hunched shoulders rising like a vulture's black feathers on either side of the grub-white blade of a face.
Never seen him,
gasped Culpepper.
I'm slipping! I'm slipping! Oh, Jesus!
Perhaps you've heard his name,
said Holmes, feeling the strength in his restraining hand beginning to fade.
Moriarty. Professor James Moriarty.
No! Never!
Cried Culpepper, and Holmes could see in his eyes that he was lying.
Perfect.
Holmes shot a brief glance at the surviving Finn, still slumped against the wall and holding his bleeding head. He'd ceased moaning and had seen and heard everything well enough, but there was no fight left in him. Blood from the scalp wound had soaked his fingers, wrists, and sleeves. Holmes put away the photos and pulled Culpepper back from the edge. He didn't believe he'd get any more. What had he learned? That Lucan might or might not have been in Washington 2 or more years ago. That Culpepper had definitely heard of Professor Moriarty, but almost certainly hadn't seen him. Holmes released his grip on the stocky man and looked at the floor. Blood had pooled completely around the dead Finn's head. Murtrick's body lay across the dead man's legs, his bullet-shattered head no longer recognizable as something that had once been human. The surviving Finn had managed to scrunch back further from his dead brother and boss. The bleeding Finn's eyes were as big as saucers, staring at Holmes through his carmine-stained fingers.
All this for the information that Lucan might have been in Washington and in touch with the Tufts a few years ago? And that the criminal organization here simply knows of Moriarty?
He was assailed by a sudden sadness, amplified to something like grief by the fading of the first freedom of the heroine.
He should have left all this drama aside and simply cold-cocked and kidnapped Mr. J and interrogated him.
He was the only one Holmes had encountered this afternoon who might know if they'd done business with Lucan. Holmes sighed and turned his back on Culpepper as if to retrieve his dropped club. The Bowie knife had been sticking hilt up only inches from Culpepper's right boot. The big man tugged the blade out with a grunt